Apologies that I'm late, just to prove to you that I am human and normal. We're week three of our series talking about narcissism and narcissistic behavior, tracking it, and today we'll also move in towards the end of what we do about it, and also next 2 weeks we'll do that as well. So just a quick review from last week. So we had a look at some of the... Jody, if you want to... And that's the one there. We had a look at some of the symptoms of narcissism. We also talked about the phenomenon that narcissists or people with narcissistic behavior often enter into relationships very quickly. They're very charming and confident, and that sort of attracts people, but also it falls apart very quickly as well, because people can't live with narcissists. Same thing with leadership. People become CEOs, bosses of companies, and so on very quickly, but also turns out to be normally a disaster. So we dealt, that was just part of it, but for the bulk of the last week's session, we dealt with the struggle or the balance that the authors of these books have, and they talk about, yes, but you need the pushback. In other words, you need some confidence, and you need some narcissism, which helps sometimes on social media for good things, as we talked about last week, the ice bucket challenge and so on. And what we explained was that that's true, but it's not about balance, actually. And that was the idea we shared last week. It's actually not about balance, about where the foundation of the confidence is coming from. Nothing wrong with confidence. It's good, and nothing wrong with positive self-esteem, as we talked about in the first session. But it depends what the foundation is, drawing on the Shavuot principle of God giving the Torah on a mountain, but the lowest mountain, because the foundation was humility, but a mountain nonetheless, because our talents and skill sets that God gave us are important. It's just, they're important when they're not based on ego, but they're based on a higher value and a God-given purpose, and so on and so forth. Okay. So what I want to do today is have a look at a very interesting chapter in one of the books that I was talking about, the book by Keith Campbell and Gene Twenge, called The Epidemic of Narcissism. It's chapter 4, and it tracks... I'm going to tell you why I'm looking at this chapter in a minute, but it tracks the development of narcissism and narcissistic behavior since the 60s or even before. In other words, it talks about the roots of the epidemic, right? What that means is, in other words, that the celebrity culture that we talked about and social media platforms, things like that, is not the cause of narcissism, but it's an outcome of something that enhances, and it's something that enhances and magnifies, but actually started long before with a much more fundamental issue. So we talked a little bit about the self-esteem, negative self-esteem versus positive self-esteem, but now we're going to look a bit deeper even. Now, the reason I'm looking at this chapter, first of all, it's a very interesting read. It's just an interesting way of looking at it. But more importantly, I think what they do is they raise some important issues, which I want to share with you, particularly from a Jewish perspective. So just a quick note, the chapter that we're going to look at is, you just need context. The context is very much about the development of the American society, because that's where this book was written. But I think it's universal. I think the principles are uniform and generic to everyone. America's a pretty big mess at the moment, but I think we here in Australia are headed that way too. We're just a bit behind, that's all, Normally, we're just always a little bit behind what happens in America. But I don't mean that pessimistically. I mean, we could do something about it, but it's very much, on a value-based system, very much headed that way, not quite that way, but so we're always a bit behind, so the context is very similar. But just the language and the context is certainly American journey. So the theory is that the 70s, right, the 1970s is sort of a big turning point in terms of the trend of narcissism. And they write, in fact, if we had to place a date on the beginning of the narcissism epidemic, it would be sometime during the 70s. But he says, or they say, we need to go back before then. And they talk about some of the core original ideas and values. Again, the context is the American society. And they say that what happened was that some of the original values, which didn't include narcissism or self-admiration, but were modified and turned into self-admiration. So we need to see what that means. Because he says, as we know, we've said this last week, that one of the key elements of narcissism is to understand the value that people place on self-admiration, which is obviously destructive. And originally, or not so long ago, it wasn't a core value. It wasn't a core value of society. And again, they're talking about the American. It wasn't a core American value. Yeah. So it's a tremendous focus on self and really admiring self, which is really has no purpose.
Qualities or just in general?
General. Well, sometimes what happens is when it spirals into a narcissistic sort of context, it actually is a delusional admiration. In other words, it becomes admiring. But even, I mean, it starts with admiring things which you do have. You know, and it's true. It's interesting you bring that up because, you know, at the very beginning of the book of Tanya, he talks about some unhealthy emotions or unhealthy traits, right? That come from the animal soul. He mentions two things there called, and one of them is gava, and the other one is hitporut, which both mean arrogance, actually, right? But actually, they're very different. So gava is an arrogance when people are arrogant about things that they do possess, which we shouldn't be arrogant about anyway. We should never feel superior or arrogant or self-admire just because we have certain talents. They're God-given. Everyone has their strengths and weaknesses, and we need to make room for others. But then what happens is it spirals into real narcissism, which is really hits parut, which is self-flaunting and self-thing, even when they have nothing to show for it. It's just a sort of self-grandizement kind of thing, right? Yeah. So, he sort of, I'm not going to go through all the literature, you can read it yourself if you want, but it goes through, sort of backs up the statement that it wasn't really part of society, it wasn't part of the values of society, whereas nowadays, it is common talk, right? So, even when they talk about self-esteem, and we spoke about this at length 2 weeks ago, and what they call it in the book, and this is their words, the mindless psychobabble that you have to love yourself before you can love someone else. Now, we spoke about this 2 weeks ago, just to clarify once again very briefly. It doesn't mean we shouldn't love ourselves, but actually it's not so much about loving ourselves. It really means accepting ourselves and understanding our own intrinsic worth. But what they say is, and that's sort of the healthy self-esteem that we talked about 2 weeks ago, what they're talking about is the focus on loving oneself and sort of focusing on oneself, and that being a prerequisite to loving others, which they claim, and I think correctly so, is nonsense to suggest that it's a prerequisite to loving others. I don't think it is. It's we just need to love others and make room for others. We do that when we're comfortable with ourselves. That's two different things. Being comfortable with ourselves because we understand our true essential definition of the soul, and if we understand that the soul defines us, we can make room for others. That's healthy. The constant focus on self-admiration and self-love is actually unhealthy. Now, they start talking about, just I want to track a little bit just so you understand where this is all going. They talk about the original American values, which we know is life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, which are all nice things. I'm not so sure about the pursuit of happiness. We spoke about this last series. You've got to actually pursue the things that make you happy, not pursue happiness itself. Okay, but we'll leave that for now. But he says that originally what happened, that these freedoms and these individualism which the American dream sort of pursued, was not about actually excluding others. In fact, the Bill of Rights and other parts of the Constitution and so on was actually carefully, to use their words, carefully balanced freedom of individual action and fundamental equality and tolerance of others. That's what it was meant to be, right? Looking out for others, caring for others, and so on and so forth. So it wasn't a very narcissistic set of principles. Also, one of the original values, which we know are very in line with Jewish values, of course, is hard work and responsibility, right? So hard work is fundamental to any success in life. We've mentioned that many times, certainly in line with Jewish values, that, as we know, the Talmud tells us, if anyone tells you, we've mentioned this many times, if anyone tells you that I've worked hard and not succeeded, you should not believe them. Conversely, if everyone says, I haven't worked hard and I did succeed, you should also not believe them. If someone says, I've worked hard and succeeded, you should believe them, right? So that's a fundamental principle. God, and by the way, and that's on every level. That could be in successful, in material things, but also means success in intellectual pursuit, it means success in emotional health, in self-refinement, in personal growth. All of these things need work. That's God's design. There's nothing we can do about that, or maybe it's a good thing. No, it is not. Maybe it is a good thing, and we have spent time, you know, other times explaining why that is. But that's the fact. The fact is that we're all created with an inner struggle. We're all created with a godly soul and an animal soul. We are all put here to struggle, not struggle in a negative way, but I mean to work hard to overcome our weaknesses, to work through, become stronger as a result of that, and to grow. And growth needs work, right? So, where in contrast, they sort of make a point that the current ethic of self-admiration, in contrast, declares that it's not necessary to do anything to be special or to like yourself. You're just special as you are. You're special, you're amazing, you're fantastic, and no work needed, which of course is a big problem. But it wasn't always that way, right? So they make an interesting point. They turn to where it started to change, but didn't change quite in a narcissistic way, but they talk about the 60s. Some of you might remember the 60s. I was only born in the 60s, so I don't... I can't claim the first-hand evidence of this, okay? Sorry?
You weren't...
I was born in the 60s.
You were.
I said I was only born in the 60s.
You weren't...
No. I was born 64, but I
Oh, you're young.
Yeah, I'm young. Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Because
my kids are starting to tell me that I'm old, but... So I appreciate that. But you know, a lot has been said about the 60s, which some people may remember, if those remember the 60s, might remember it as an era of, you know, hippiness and drug use and maybe the beginnings of narcissism, right? But they make a point, an interesting point, and I'll tell you, just bear with me, because you're going to see why this point is important, because a real interesting issue comes out through this. They say that actually the 60s was not really a narcissistic area. I mean, it was a wild era, I should say. But a lot of good things happened, like the Peace Corps, and people did a lot for other people, and so on and so forth. And a lot of the, you know, substance use and the hippiness that went on in those times actually didn't result in narcissistic behavior, funnily enough. I'm not saying it was a good thing necessarily, but it didn't result in narcissism. In fact, it resulted in doing for others, caring for others in a bigger way, in a stronger way, right? What did develop, they mentioned, what did develop was a movement of human potential, like self-actualization. That was a big thing, apparently, then, right? Because there was a big emphasis in introspection, self-improvement, which started then a lot, right? And interestingly enough, by the way, and this I've heard from many people, it was a time of great searching. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, who spoke in the 60s and talked about the youth, said that the time that they were in then was a tremendous opportunity. He said, because the way he saw it, interesting, in his typical optimistic way, he saw it as a time of searching. The people were digging into themselves more and they were searching. And in fact, if you track the Chabad, sort of Chabad house movement, or it was called differently then, I know people who were around then, and I have relatives who were shluchim on college campuses and things like that. Actually, it was a time of amazing awakening. There were many, many people who reconnected with their Judaism then, actually. Because, in fact, it was just channeling the self-introspection that was going on there, right? So, in essence, it wasn't such a bad thing. Because self-actualization, the way they define self-actualization in their book, and we mentioned this 2 weeks ago, is a movement which actually drives you to actualize your potential. Actualizing your potential, number one, is hard work. In fact, it's not a narcissistic concept. The way they put it is self-actualization includes sharing one's sympathy and benevolence with other people. Maslow placed self-actualization at the top of his famous hierarchy of human needs and described it as a very difficult to achieve. In fact, he could only identify a few people who were truly self-actualized. Because it wasn't just about self, it was about our self-potential that we do. Understand that everyone has potential, everyone has competencies, everyone has things that they could achieve, but that includes making room for others, it includes doing for others, it includes being kind to others, and so on and so forth. But here's the interesting thing, right? Although and we're going to talk about this more in a few minutes, it did create a movement of introspection and self-actualization. But at the end of the day, it was still about self, and therefore it was very easy for it to derail. And that's exactly what happened. Right? So in the 70s, you had the whole negative self-esteem thing that began. And this is an amazing line that they put, and I'm going to unpack it in a moment. They say by the 70s, the 60s goals of self-exploration had begun to transition naturally into a goal of self-expression. And this is the point they make, that self-exploration and self-expression are very different, right? And he says that in many ways, the theme of our current age. He says the baby boomer idea of self-exploration and finding yourself sounds narcissistic, and often it is, but it can also lead to greater maturity and eventually a return to the community. And he cites a lot of big people, heads of different religions and movements and so on, that actually took off time to self-explore, detach themselves from the community a bit, to actually go deep within themselves, but then return to do a lot of good, right? In other words, found a higher purpose within themselves, found a higher potential within themselves, right? But it doesn't always do that. That's the problem. And the way they put it is, self-exploration sounds similar to self-expression. Both, for example, emphasize individuality. Self-expression, however, is much easier to do. All you have to do is talk about yourself, draw attention to yourself, and sometimes promote yourself as self-expression, right? Which is a lot of what's happening today, self-expression, not self-exploration. Different. Yeah. So that's the point I make. Now I wanna spend some time unpacking this. Why that happened and what needs to happen to make sure that doesn't happen. Because one would imagine self-exploration is a very good thing. We have it in Judaism. Cheshbon ha-nefesh. Right, we've talked about that many times. When we come to Elul, we're supposed to. We're not supposed to do it all day and all night, but we're supposed to once in a while take stock. Right? The early Hasidic Jews would do this every night. When they would read the bedtime Shema, they would spend time reflecting on the day. Did I accomplish something today? Did I spend today purposefully? Did I realize my potential? And if not, maybe not. I should correct what I need to do. I should make today I should make tomorrow a better day, and so on. We have that once a month before Rosh Chodesh. The most emphasized time for that is the month of Elul, leading up to Rosh Hashanah. So it's not a concept which is foreign to Jewish thinking. Nor is the concept of self-help and self-growth and personal growth. I mean, it's all about that. We just came from a period between Pesach and Shavuot where we counted the Omer, which in Judaism is a time for refinement. You can't refine yourself without exploring yourself, right? You need to know what's wrong, what's right. We need to know our strengths, our weaknesses. We need to focus on ourselves. And therefore, that whole personal growth movement or self-exploration or even self-actualization has a place. It makes sense. However, this is what we need to understand. There's always although it's amazing, but it always needs something to keep it in check. And even deeper than that, as we'll soon see. Because as we've mentioned a number of times, the danger of the self-help and personal growth movement is the word self. There's always a danger. When we focus on self, even if it's for a really good cause, there's always a danger. There's always a danger that we become self-absorbed. Right? And sometimes, by the way, that's inevitable. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. Sometimes there's no other choice. Like, you have to just pay that price to some degree. I'll give you an example. One of the most successful models, normally that comes together with other therapies, but one of the most successful models in addictions today, real addictions I'm talking about, whether it's alcohol addiction, drug addiction, internet addiction, porn addiction, whatever it is the 12-step program. The 12-step program is very effective, and that's helped thousands and thousands of, I mean, since its beginnings, which is a while ago, it's helped millions of people, really helped millions of people, in very, very healthy recovery. But it's very intense. It requires, that's a very emphasized and sort of, very emphasized sort of journey of personal growth, where it requires people to go to meetings a number of times a week, it requires them to have a sponsor, it requires them to do all things which are excellent. But if you ever really looked at it, you will notice that sometimes, and inevitably so, and it's not a bad thing, you can't help it, because it's way better than being an addict, that people who are involved in that are, not all, but sometimes, they're very focused on themselves. And if you've had the experience, if those who've spoken to people, and in a good way, but nevertheless still very self-conscious and self-exploring, and which is part of the journey, right? So I'm saying, so the self part of personal growth sometimes creates a little bit of emphasis on self, which is always dangerous, right? The emphasis on self is always dangerous. But sometimes it's good and sometimes inevitable. Now, here's the danger. Recently, this thought came out in my mind. It's a recent idea, which I think is correct, but it's a recent idea which I clarified in my own mind with a conversation I had with someone. A very interesting phenomenon. But I just need to give it a context. So the context is an idea that I've shared with you before, more than once. It's an idea that comes from the four cups of wine we drink on Pesach. You might remember the idea. But we know that we drink four cups of wine corresponding to the four expressions of redemption, right? Where God took us out of Egypt and he said, I'll take you out, I'll redeem you and I'll save you. And then he said, I will take you as a nation, right? Okay. So we drink four cups corresponding to those four expressions of redemption. Now, when we talk about those four expressions of redemption, we've noted before that if you look at them, you'll see that the first three is about what we're letting go of, right? So I will save you from Egypt. I'll redeem you from Egypt. I will redeem you from Egypt. The fourth is what we're going to become, right? V'lakachti etchem am, we're going to become God's nation. That's the fourth expression. And so there's a very interesting halakha that tells us that, are we allowed to interrupt between the cups of wine? You might remember this. I've shared this with you a number of times. So the halakha is that, although the custom is not to, but theoretically, if you're game enough to have more wine between the first and the second cup, you're allowed to do that. Between the second and the third, which is the meal time, for sure you're allowed to do that. But there's a very strong law in Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, that Bein Gimel Ledalet Lo Yafsik, that you should not interrupt between the third and the fourth cup. And we've always asked the idea, what's the idea behind that? What's the concept? And the concept is that, and this is the way we've always shared it, but I want to take it to a little bit of a deeper level today. So the way we've always shared the idea is this, that the first three is letting go, right? So we all have a period of self-redemption in our lives. We let go of things. So for example, if someone wants to let go of their resentment, let go of their jealousy, let go of gossiping towards other people, I don't know, let go of any weak trait or negative or toxic sort of experience, right? So we let go. But then the question, let's say we are successful in letting go. But then we have to ask ourselves the question, okay, so we let go of that, but what are we replacing it with? In other words, if we let go of toxic things, of resentment of others or jealousy of others or hate of others or any spiritual toxicity or weakness, whatever the case is, that's good. That's an amazing step. But once you let go of something, you've created a vacuum. And that vacuum can attract something else undesirable. It can attract something else which is negative, right? And that's the depth of this law. That the first three expressions of redemption is the letting go of toxic stuff. So you're successful. You've achieved the first three parts of the expressions. That means I've let go of Egypt. I've let go of my own personal Egypt, my own personal journey of Egypt, my own restrictions, my own imprisonment. But what am I replacing it with? So therefore the Torah tells us, or the halakha says, between the third and the fourth, do not interrupt, because you need to replace it with something else, and it's becoming God's nation in that context, right? So therefore, otherwise, if you're not replacing it with something meaningful and purposeful, you are leaving it open to attract undesirable stuff. Okay. So what does that look like, right? So we need to understand, we need to look at the concept of freedom. And here I think is where it goes wrong a lot of times. So, going back to what they talk about in the book, in the original sort of American value system, freedom was an important value. Freedom of religion, freedom for individuals, freedom, eventually freedom from slavery, right? People should be free to express themselves and to, well, not express themselves in a negative way, but I'm saying to be who they are and so on. But it meant also creating a community, freedom for everyone to be together, freedom to include others, to be tolerant of others, and so on. But it doesn't always look like that because people misunderstand what freedom means. So sometimes, right, and here, this is the light bulb that I had a few weeks ago. It sort of crystallized a bit. And it's very much what they're talking about here and why self-exploration can become self-expression in a negative way and narcissism. Very, very often, the toxicity people go through, the negativity, a negative experience, even the trauma people go through, is all built on what Edith Eger talks about, the concept of victimhood, right? And we become victim to other people. So, for example, jealousy. Jealousy means we're defining ourselves by other people. Resentment, hate, right? Often people are hugely impacted by what other people did to them, by what other people said to them, the way they were treated by parents, by teachers, who knows what, anything, right? And they ruminate on that and they become a victim to that. So it becomes a victimhood, which is bad. We know how unhealthy being a victim is. And therefore the process of growing, the process of self-improvement, is to try and let go of that, right? So, you know, like I've always mentioned what Rabbi Twersky said, that we often let people live in our minds rent-free, all that kind of stuff, right? So we let go of that. And what happens is we kind of break out. We break free from a prison. What's the prison? The prison of other people. The prison of other things, right? And then what? And then what? So what I was thinking is, and tell me if you agree with me, but and I think this is what happens a lot of times, and I'll tell you why I think it happens, but let me tell you first what happens. When you free from self, when you free yourself from other people or other forces or other influences that have been holding you back, imprisoning you, right? The concept like of going out of Mitzrayim, we were prisoners to others, right? And I'm talking about now emotionally or psychologically or spiritually. When we break free from being prison to others, what are we left with? So we're left with ourselves. We are free. Where do we go from there? What often happens is we let go of victimhood and instead we become prisoners to ourselves instead. In other words, we become self-absorbed, we engage in self-admiration, self-incarceration. I've heard people say this, I no longer am resentful, I no longer have a problem with other people, but I'm a fantastic person, so I'm special. And it becomes a journey of breaking free from the prison of other people, transitioning to a prison of ourselves. And I think that's maybe the Jewish angle or the spiritual angle about what they talk about in the book, moving from self-exploration to self-expression. In other words, I don't need anyone anymore. No one's holding me back, but what is holding me back is myself. So I become imprisoned in myself, right? And that's a big problem. Why is that? So why does that happen? Because in the Jewish literature, freedom on its own is not a value. Do you know that? Not a value. I mean, it depends on what you mean by freedom. Free, this idea of being free, is not a value. The value is that we have the ability to make a choice. That's the freedom we have. Right? In other words, as human beings, I know this sounds bizarre, so let me just explain it a bit, right? The freedom that we have is not to be free, it's to make a choice who we submit to. That's what Judaism is about. Because us people left our own devices, bad news. What's that old book called? Which I don't think is completely accurate in terms of Jewish wisdom. We read it in school, what's it called? About those kids that get dumped on an island? Lord of the Flies, yeah. I remember having a big argument with my teacher about it. Because I said it's not in line with... I was like this in high school already. I said it's not in line with Jewish thinking. The reason I said that was because the conclusion the book came to was that people are intrinsically bad. And I don't think that's right. People aren't intrinsically bad. We have a soul, and the soul is intrinsically good, right? We don't subscribe to that part of Freudian psychology. We're not lustful beings at our very core, right? We're actually not. We're actually pure human beings and holy human beings and spiritual human beings. And we have the ability to grow and to be godly and to make choices, to choose right over wrong, moral over immoral, and so on and so forth, right? But our conscious being, as I spoke about 2 weeks ago, is an animal. That's like for most people, that's their conscious being. Our godly soul's a bit hidden. It is what defines us, as we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. That's our definition, but it's not our consciousness. For most part, our consciousness, as the book of Tanya explains, is actually our animal soul. And therefore, leave us to our devices, we'll end up like the Lord of the Flies, right? Why? We'll just become prisoners of ourselves. We might be free from being a victim, but we might replace it with narcissism. right? Because we just become, we just turn into ourselves. Because being free in itself is actually not a value. The freedom that we have, the freedom in the Jewish context, the freedom that we celebrate on Pesach, the real true freedom is the freedom to control ourselves and to submit to things that are right and moral and meaningful and purposeful. That doesn't mean free to do what we want. In fact, we're not free to do what we want at all. Right? In Judaism, we're very far from free to do what you want. But that's our freedom. Because we make the choice that rather than being victim to materialism, hedonism, other people's impressions of us, everything else that's toxic and negative that holds us back, we make a choice to be free to serve a higher purpose, to serve a higher being, to be involved in something more meaningful and purposeful. That's not free to do what you want. The degree of discipline, the degree of self-control that's expected from us in a Jewish concept is way beyond, way higher, way more than what's expected in any other discipline, right? Which is the core of that halakha, that law that says that do not interrupt between the third and the fourth cup. Because the third cup means you've let go. Fantastic. Mazel tov. That's an amazing achievement. But if you don't, you just leave yourself to be. You let go of the restriction, the external prison. But you don't replace it with almost a servitude, a submission. I don't mean a negative way, but a choice to submit to something higher than yourself. Then you will just transition from being a prisoner of others to being a prisoner of yourself. And I think that's tremendously what's happening today. The original works on self-help was not like that, as you heard me say many times. Edith Eger's work is not like that. Viktor Frankl's for sure not. All the positive psychology stuff was actually much more about meaning and purpose. A lot of the more modern self-help stuff is like that. It's very much driving people into self. And the whole society is becoming that way. And their theory is that it started with the movement of self-actualization and then went wrong into self-expression. But I think it went wrong is because around the same time in American history, you know, American foundations, for example, was based on Judeo-Christian ideas, right? You know, the research, I mean, obviously in the Jewish context, the religion that we talk about is the moral compass of the Torah. But actually this is true, that the happiness and the contentment that the research says that comes with religion, which, by the way, there's lots of research on it, this concept of having a higher being is in any discipline, any religion, right? Just about not focusing on yourself. It's about having a discipline. It's about having a higher purpose. It's about having a set of boundaries. It's about having a set of direction, compass, and a sort of a goal of what life is all about. Something deeper, something higher. Because we see that together with narcissism is a complete abandonment of religion. Right? Not only in Judaism. I'm talking about across the world, right? There's this rejection of a tremendous, huge wave. Now, don't get me wrong. There are plenty of religious narcissists. Right, I'm not promising anyone that any level of engagement with religion is the key to losing narcissism. It isn't, because there's many reasons why people are religious. Some people are religious because they're culturally religious. They're not deeply religious, right? That's for another topic. But I'm talking about the religion and the concept of. And I'm not, by the way, at this point. I mean, you know, obviously, I always recommend people should keep mitzvot and so on, but. But that's not exactly what I'm talking about. It could be any journey, and it can be everyone in their own journey. It could be just the idea of moving in the direction of something higher, and something purposeful, and something meaningful, right? Both between man and man, and man and God, whatever it is. And that's each person is on their own journey. But there is a lot of research about people who subscribe to something higher. It makes a big difference to their happiness levels, to their emotional well-being levels, and so on and so forth. So we know that historically, the shift that happened in the 70s that they talk about, which was a lot of self-absorption and self-indulgence and so on and so forth, went then in the 80s and the 90s and up to now, exploded into things now beyond technology of complete self-absorption, narcissistic behavior, celebrity culture, social media madness, and all that kind of stuff, that came all together with a progressive and continuous abandonment of anything higher, belief in God, some sort of religious engagement, some sort of discipline, some sort of higher purpose, and it goes together. So that's just the one of the ideas that I wanted to share with you. So what do we do about this, right? So we're going to talk about this more next week, but one of the things that is incredibly important, and there's a chapter in the other book, The Life of I, that they talk about this. We need to do something very, very basic, I think. And we need to start focusing on many things, but one of the things we need to focus on is the work that we need to focus on empathy. Empathy. Now, why am I highlighting empathy? And what is empathy, right? Empathy really boils down to making room within ourselves for another person. Now, I'm talking specifically about empathy and not kindness. Kindness is very, very important. Being kind to others is very, very important. But you can have kindness without empathy, and it's not enough. And I'll give you an example. You know, we talk about the celebrity culture, right? The huge self-admiration in your face kind of celebrity culture that we talked about last week and the week before. I've noticed an interesting thing, and I have to be honest, I don't watch movies for the most part, and I don't know a lot about celebrities. But the little bit I do know, I've picked up an interesting thing about them. But I'm not that old, and some of them are very nice, I'm sure, and I'm sure they mean well and all that kind of stuff. But I have noticed with huge celebrities that they have a hugely dysfunctional relationship life. Fair statement?
Yes.
Okay. So, and yet, interestingly enough, who was that? I'm completely ignorant when it comes to this, but who was that movie star that died a number of years ago and she had like 8 marriages or something? Yeah, something like that. So, yeah. So, they don't seem to do very well in relationships. I mean, lots of people have troubles in relationships, and relationships, of course, are two ways, and sometimes it's important to end the relationship, and, you know, all that's true. But generally, we live in a society today that relationships are doing pretty badly, right? I think the divorce rate is like 1 in 2 or something, or that's if you bother getting into a relationship to begin with. Now people are even not even getting into relationships, committed relationships. So that's in itself an interesting thing. So it's pretty bad. And among the very famous, yeah, it seems to be more. And yet, interesting thing, we find with the same people that they're very famous for like acts of tremendous kindness that they do. You ever see that? Like, you know, helping kids in Africa or something, right? Mm-hmm. Which seems very selfless and all that. I'm sure it's a good thing, and it is a good thing, right? Donating money to research, medical research and stuff like that, right? And it's an interesting question how those two things go together. I hope I'm not being too controversial today, but anyway, and it's interesting how those two things go together. Now, those things are amazing, and you know, you always hear me say this. If there's a doubt whether to give or not to give, always give. Because giving is a good thing. It can never go wrong. But giving doesn't make you necessarily a selfless person. In fact, on the contrary, there can be many motives for people that give, right? And giving, particularly to people or to causes that don't affect me, is a very interesting part of giving. It's very important. But it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily a truly giving person. You understand? Truly giving person means someone who can make room for someone that you live with. That's real giving. And that's not kindness, that's empathy. Very different. You know, I've shared with you, this is not around this time of the year, but you know, there's a festival of giving, it's called Purim, right? When we give Mishlach Manot Matanot La'Evyonim. And it's interesting because it Mishlach Manot is food gifts you send to your friends, and Matanot La'Evyonim is gifts you give to the poor, right? And I shared with you an idea a couple times that it's two parts of giving, and you have to have both. So Matanot La'Evyonim is giving gifts to poor people that you don't know who they are, right? Very often on Purim, people give to a synagogue fund that they distribute to people in need, you don't even know who you're giving to. And that's fine, because there are people in need. And when I say people in need, on Purim, it means financially, but it doesn't always mean financially, it can mean anything. And that's very important. Community, society functions by people giving. And you need to help people, even causes out there. But you also have to give Mishlach Manot. Mishlach Manot is about giving to your friends, to those who are close to you. Because sometimes we find one or the other, right? Sometimes people are very good at giving to a poor person in Timbuktu, but they're not so good at being nice and kind and empathic to people who are close to them. Others are very family-based, and they're very good at running a family, but they're not interested in the community. And that's a problem too. That's a big problem. But when we talk about this concept of not being of what brings selflessness is not just about giving to causes. It's about, and that's kindness, and kindness is very important. But it's much more than that. It's about empathy, which empathy we know is on the decline, right? We know it's on the decline. Because, and for all sorts of reasons, partly to do with technology. But empathy means understanding another's world and making room for another and really being sensitive, putting yourself in someone else's shoes, picking up the signal of where someone else is emotionally needy or reaching out or going through a tough time and really making room for that person within your own experience. That's the complete, one of the antidotes to narcissism. To learn, and it's a trained thing. We can teach ourselves empathy if we don't have it enough. We can work on it. We can start to notice things. We can slow down and notice other people. We can try and notice what other people need. Now, there's an amazing little idea which I'll share with you. When the temple stood in Jerusalem, there was a miracle that took place in the temple times, particularly on Yom Kippur. The Talmud tells us that when the Jews would come for pilgrimage for Yom Kippur, there was lots and lots of people. And they would stand in the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple. And there'd be a lot of them, and it would be very squishy. And yet, there's a part, you might have noticed this in Shul, we do it even today, there was a part of the temple service when the Kohen Gadol, when the high priest would utter the name of God, the special name of God, the way it's written, the way we don't pronounce it today, then everyone would bow down. So the Talmud says there was a phenomenal miracle, which we don't understand, but it was a miracle that took place in the temple, a supernatural phenomenon, that omdim tsefufim, when they would stand, they'd be squashed, it would be very squishy, because there was so many people there. But mishtachavim, when they would bow down, rivachim, there was plenty of place. That's the miracle. So there's a very famous Hasidic interpretation of this line, that it means something different on a deeper level. And it says like this, omdim, when a person is standing, meaning they stand their own ground, they protect themselves endlessly, they're always focused on themselves and absorbed in themselves, tsufufim is always very squashy. There's just no room for others. And others just interfere and unsettle us, right? Breeds intolerance. We get triggered by other people. We get annoyed with other people quickly and so on and so forth. But mishtachavim, when we are bowed down, which means we should be a bit more humble, when we are subdued a little bit, when we just don't take ourselves so seriously a little bit, and we're not standing our ground, but we're more engaging in humble living, revachim, there's plenty of place. It's a very important concept, right? So, this goes to something we spoke about before. if freedom is when we free ourselves from Mitzrayim, from an external prison, but then we need to replace it with connecting ourselves with something higher, that also takes humility, right? That means we need to be able to make room for something higher than ourselves. How do we do that? We do that by creating empathy to other people. You know, there's an amazing concept that... a saying of our sages, that Derech Eretz Kodma LaTorah, respect for other people comes before Torah. Now that was a very misused expression by all teachers in all the ages. When kids would behave not nicely, they would always say, oh, Derech Eretz Kodma LaTorah, don't forget, you know, Derech Eretz comes before Torah. It means that too, but it's not quite what it means. What it means is as follows, right? Because if you look in the actual book of Torah, there's an interesting phenomenon. You know, I talked about Shavuot last week, and we celebrate Shavuot, and was giving the Torah at Mount Sinai, which was the ultimate experience of the Jewish nation, right? The purpose of creation, the purpose of Exodus from Egypt was Sinai, was becoming God's nation, submitting to the moral code, the moral compass of the Torah, and so on and so forth. And yet, when you look in the Chumash, you'll see that Genesis, the whole book of Genesis, doesn't make any mention of Torah, nor does the first part of Exodus, only it's like a long, you know, the first 2,000 years people were of creation from Adam onwards, there was no Torah. 26 generations, our sages tell us, right? So what were people doing? What was the purpose of that? What was the purpose of if the purpose of creation was to receive the Torah at Mount Sinai, so what were people doing until the Torah was given? And one of the answers is, if you look in the story of the Chumash, the story of Torah until the Torah was given, you'll see it's a story of human relationships. That's what it was. Why? Because if you can't make room for another person, you certainly can't make room for God or for any other higher purpose of that matter. Right? Because don't forget, make room for other people, these people like us. To make room for a higher being, make room for God, make room for something more meaningful and a higher purpose and a moral code which is beyond us, that takes much more humility. That's why there's a phenomenal, I've mentioned this before, there's a phenomenal passage in the Talmud where God says, the sages quote this and they say that God says that he can coexist with any human being no matter how low they may fall. It's no problem. God is very tolerant. We may sin, we may be not a good person, we may do lots of terrible things. And God says, no problem, I'm still with you. Except for one type of person, the arrogant person. Why? Very simple. Because God is a very tolerant God. He can coexist with you wherever you may be on your rung, on your spiritual rung, but only if you let him in. Right? He says, I'm with you if you let me in. I'll help you, I'll help you grow, I'll assist you, I'll inspire you, we'll grow together, but only if you let me in. So says, therefore, says the Talmud, there's one thing God says, I'm sorry, I can't coexist with anyone that's an arrogant person because he's not letting me in. Right? So therefore, if we want to replace, if we don't want to interrupt it between the third and the fourth cup, if we want to make sure that when we talk about freedom, we are free to self-actualize, that means revealing our potential, our real potential, which means to reveal our real potential, to reveal our core essence of who we are, which is the soul, that spark that seeks meaning, that seeks purpose, that seeks an accomplished life in a very meaningful and deep way. If you want to do that, we have to be able to make room and make room for other people to begin with. And that's why empathy is such an important first step to dealing with the epidemic of narcissism and narcissistic behavior. Empathy is a hard thing to do. It really means being sensitive, being tuning in to another human being outside myself. How we do that is an important discussion, and we'll have that discussion hopefully next week, among other things that we can do to prevent that epidemic of narcissism and narcissistic behavior. Have a wonderful day. Bye.